All right, welcome everyone to today's Google Search Central SEO Office Hours Hangout. My name is John Mueller. I'm a search advocate at Google here in Switzerland. And part of what we do are these office hour hangouts where people can jump in and ask their questions around search, and we'll try to find some answers. As always, a bunch of stuff was submitted on YouTube. We can take a look at that. And maybe to get things started, we can take some live questions as well. I see Bruchan, if I got your name right. You have your hand raised. Do you want to get started? Hi.
How are you? How are you doing?
Pretty good. Let me just see. Bhushan, are you here somewhere?
Yes, John. Could you give me 1 minute? I'm just dealing with something else.
Okay.
Sorry.
Let me take the next one first, then. Eric.
Yes. Hello again. I noticed that you rolled out a new feature in the Search Console, some page experience tab. And I wonder, there's a counter of views, and I can't correlate it to any other metric. For us, it shows like 12 million, of views. But then in the SERP tab, which shows views in the search results, it's like three times as much. So what does this number like correspond to in the page experience?
Okay, I don't know offhand without taking a look, but my understanding is the number of impressions that we show there are specifically for the pages that reach the good threshold. So the pages that we can kind of classify in that good bucket. And if a lot of your site is in the good bucket, then probably a lot of your pages will be in there. If parts of the views do not map into that good bucket, then that's probably that difference that you're seeing there.
Yeah, it shows 100% for us. So does it mean like all of our pages are OK? Or?
It sounds like it. Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
It sounds
congratulations.
Like good. Thank you. Yeah, it's a lot of work when internet. But it's still like only a third of what we get in the SERP tab. So
yeah, I don't know if those are meant to map one-to-one. I'd have to ask.
Okay. You know, on some days it's on like two times as much. On some days it's like 3.5 times as much. I mean, it shows in that SERP tab.
Or could that be that the mobile users versus
users? But I don't know, like that's still like too much, I think, of a difference.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you. Thank you very much. And I have another question. My last
sure.
One. Thank you. In the coverage tab, where is it? Yes, usability. Yes, mobile usability, I think it is, or something like that. Core Web Vitals. I'm sorry. Core Web Vitals. And for the past 2 years, the way we've been trying to optimize for Google, the graph that's there to show you the good pages and the pages that need some attention, it's been steady for those years. But in the past 2 months, it just started like going up and down. And I don't know. I thought it was something to do with that crawl budget thing, but I don't know. We have zero bad pages. We have zero. Yellow ones. All of our pages are in green, but it went from 45,000 to like 27,000, and now it's like 30. So I wonder why it is.
Yeah, I think that's a bit confusing. So basically, what happens in the aggregate reports is that we show the information from a significant sample of the pages of the website. And depending on the website, that can be almost all pages. Sometimes it's less than all pages. And that sample can change over time. So for example, when you're looking at speed, if if your pages do not change with regards to speed, you might still see the number of pages going up and down there. And that's just based on us using a slightly different sample. So essentially, what you should watch out for there is the errors that are mentioned there. And look at a sample of those errors that are mentioned and work based on that. I wouldn't assume that the total number that is shown there in these aggregate reports maps one-to-one to the total number that you have in index coverage, for example.
Yeah, that's right. It's a lot less. Yep. OK. Yeah. OK, thank you.
Sure. Bhushan, are you ready?
Actually, it was regarding to the crawlability issues, or the answer is already covered by you. So I'm done.
OK.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Cool. Rahul?
Hi, John.
Hi.
So I'm having multiple questions. The first question is about 301 redirect. So my question is that I have implemented 301 redirect for a page, and it's working fine. The page is being redirected to the new URL. But the thing is, Google is not selecting the new one as a canonical URL. And it is indexing both the pages as two different pages. So what can be the, should I do anything externally to provide that this is one, the new URL is the one as canonical, or anything like that?
Yeah. So when it comes to canonicals, we essentially recognize that these two pages are equivalent. And then we try to pick one of them to show in the search results. There is no ranking advantage from having this one or the other one shown. It's purely a matter of which one is shown in the search results and which one is used for attribution in Search Console. So it's not super critical. But when it comes to canonicalization, we use redirects as one signal, but we also use other signals as well, like internal links, sitemap files, external links, all of the annotations that you have across your pages, all of that can play in. And it can happen that you redirect one page to another page, but our systems say the canonical should remain the original URL. And the way that you can help us to switch that over is to just make sure that everything is aligned, that all of your internal links are pointing at the new URL, your external links are pointing at the new URL. In the sitemap file and all of the annotations that you have, you always point to the new URL. And then when we look at the bigger picture, we see, oh, like it's pretty clear. You want that one indexed, so we'll focus on that one. But like I said, there is no ranking change or anything. So it's not that there's anything critical that you need to do.
OK. Another question is that I've come across a video of Matt Cutts for link building. That video was uploaded 11 years ago. So my question is that in the video, he proposed that if we do like answering questions on forums or communities like Quora, it can help building authority or kind of backlinks for your site. So is it helpful in this period also?
I don't remember what all Matt said, so it's hard for me to say. In general, a lot of the sites that use user-generated content, they use a nofollow on all of their links. So it's rare that you would get any kind of advantage out of that. It's also something where over the years, we've seen that people try to abuse this for link building, and that they'll go to forums and just add random unrelated comments and add their links there. And that's something that we would recognize as being kind of almost like borderline spammy behavior.
OK. One more question. We are having a product page. In that, we are having multiple products on same category. So what is happening is all the products almost we are having 10 parameters for every product, and almost 8 parameters are remaining same for every product. So my question is, does Google consider it as thin content or anything like that? Because we are not changing all the parameters.
No, it sounds essentially just like you have different parameters, and some parameters are not critical. And usually what happens is we learn which parameters are not critical, and we tend not to focus on them. You can also tell us about that in the URL parameter handling tool. If that's something that where you have a clear map of which parameters are actually important and which ones aren't. But it's not thin content.
OK, thank you.
Sure. Melissa.
Hello. Hi. I am a director of engineering for The Atlantic, and have a couple questions about AMP and Google News for you.
Okay. I'll try. I don't know everything around Google News, so
sure.
I might be the wrong person, but we'll see.
No, I'm curious because so we've got the JSON LD for the news article rich results on all of our pages. And we're seeing some different things between the news.google.com results for articles and the default search. And so I was wondering if they use different algorithms or like pull metadata from different places to populate the results.
I don't know.
That's okay.
It sounds like we are based on what you've seen. So for the most part, we would crawl the same way for news and for web. But it's very possible that depending on how we need to process that information, that we have slightly different pipelines from there. So I could imagine that there might be subtle differences in that regard.
Cool. OK, that makes sense. And then I just have another question about mobile results right now with AMP and obviously ramping up on the core web vitals. We've seen, and I've noticed this on other like news US publications results, that the AMP and the their core site, the results are mixed. So it's not all AMP articles, or it's not all kind of the mobile web experience. So I was wondering, in this interim period between now and when core web vitals become the main signal for results, where should we be focusing? Where should publishers be focusing on improving the AMP experience or improving core web vitals for ranking currently?
Essentially, core web vitals would apply to both. So when it comes to the core web vitals, especially the speed aspect, what is it? Largest contentful paint, cumulative layout shift, and first input delay, those metrics, we would use the pages that users actually see in a search result. So that's based on the field data. And if users are seeing the AMP pages in the search results, then we would base those metrics off of the AMP pages. If users are primarily seeing mobile web results, then that's what we would base those metrics on. And from that point of view, if you're seeing that your AMP pages, for example, are slow on mobile, then that's what I would focus on to kind of improve that, what users are actually seeing. It's less a matter of we will not show AMP pages later on, because we'll continue to have AMP pages. Sure. It's really just from the speed point of view, we take into account that what the users actually see.
Got it. OK. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks. Syed.
Hello, John. How are you?
Hi.
Hello.
Pretty good.
John, how are you? John, my question is regarding an e-commerce site which has a product and has descriptions. And those descriptions are very much similar to the manufacturer descriptions. So I just wanted to know, how important is it to write something unique which includes the same thing? Or probably I should go with the manufacturer's descriptions. So I came up with this question after reading the blog on product reviews. where the last point says describe the key choices in how product has been designed and their effect on users beyond what manufacturer says. So if you could please clarify this, it would be great, John.
Yeah, so in a normal e-commerce shop, you're not essentially creating review pages, you're creating these product pages. So from that point of view, I think looking at the guidance that we have for product reviews is good, but it's not critical because that's not really your primary focus. When it comes to the description on a page or on for products, it's something that we do take into account. And essentially what happens is we will index the different pages because the different shops that have the same product, the pages themselves are unique. Like they have extra other information around the product description. But if someone searches specifically for something within that shared description, then we will pick one of these pages to show because we think, oh, these other ones have essentially the same information. From that point of view, if you have something unique around your pages, then that already helps us a little bit. Having unique descriptions on their own, that also helps us a little bit to make sure that we're showing your pages. But it's not the most critical thing. In particular, if there are aspects within your shop that make it unique on its own, like if you're located in a specific location and users search for that location plus the product name, then obviously it doesn't matter if your descriptions are the same as other people's because your shop will be the most relevant one. So that's kind of my advice there. I think if you can make unique descriptions, that's always worthwhile. But depending on the type of shop that you have, the number of people that you have working there, sometimes it's just not realistic to do that for everything. Cool.
So we are an online e-commerce firm. So probably what I can, let me just convey my understanding what it's like. It's something like it's great if you could make unique. Is that what I can take from this, John?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's a good practice.
Thanks,
it's
John.
Not
Thanks.
It's not critical. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, John. Thanks for answering that.
Sure. Jeremy.
Hi, John. Just for some framing, I work for Publicis Health Media, so we're dealing with a lot of larger pharmaceutical and healthcare clients. And we've had a number of them come through and ask about personalization technologies that leverage JavaScript to kind of change the experience on a page based on the user's referring path. So like if they come through on a certain from a certain condition area, if they land on a certain page, it might alter some of the kind of calls to action or some of the multimedia on the page. And you know that's kind of a half measure that we've come up with because initially they wanted to change like everything on the page, but we were concerned about how Google might perceive that, both from a cloaking perspective or from a perspective of JavaScript crawling and not seeing everything initially, that kind of thing. So I was just curious about like whether you can put kind of a stamp on that to know like if there's any sort of best practice around that or like what sort of best practice, like what sort of guidance we need to point them at, whether it's the cloaking guidance or things like that.
Yeah, I think the cloaking guidance is definitely worthwhile to look at. We also, I believe, have some guidance on A/B testing in general. So I would take a look at that. In general, with regards to JavaScript-based A/B testing, we don't necessarily differentiate between JavaScript and other kinds of A/B testing. We can render some JavaScript. So it's possible that we would fall into one of these A/B tests and then just see that version. And then we would use that version for indexing. The one thing I would watch out for with regards to A/B tests is that Googlebot has a fairly persistent view of the pages, not that it changes every time we crawl the page. So if there's a way that you can put Googlebot into one bucket, then that makes it a lot easier for us to have kind of a stable view of your page. Shifting things around, like call to actions, changing colors, designs, things like that, that's absolutely no problem. If you were to significantly change the focus or the purpose of the page, then I think that would be something that would fall more into the cloaking area. And that would be something where, from the web spam, from the quality side, people would be kind of upset with that. But if you're just tweaking things, that's perfectly fine. The other thing maybe to mention is Googlebot doesn't keep a refer. So if you're doing A/B tests based on refer, we would just not send anything there.
OK. And just for clarity, it does look like A/B testing technology to me, but they're looking to use it in a permanent fashion. Is there a problem with that over the A/B testing end of things?
Not necessarily. So if you're tweaking things, I don't see a problem with that. If you're, again, if you're significantly changing things, then I would just make sure that Googlebot sees the primary version of the page, not that 90% of the users see one version and Googlebot sees like something different. But usually that kind of falls into place anyway.
And just for my own clarity, when you're saying like we can do user agent kind of funneling Googlebot to another area, and that's not perceived as cloaking?
I mean, that technically that falls into cloaking. But essentially, what you want to avoid is that Googlebot regularly jumps into different buckets when you're doing this kind of test. And from that point of view, some people do it by IP address or location or username or something like, or user agent. Essentially, the idea should be that you're not special case in Googlebot, and Googlebot alone is going this way, but rather like there's a whole group of people going this way, and it includes Googlebot.
OK. Cool. Thank you very much.
Sure. GK, I think. Hi,
John. Recently introduced Google Search Console Page Experience tab shows our website has 98.8% URLs with a good page experience, but Core Orbital tab shows that 10.8K failing URLs. I can't understand what it shows. Kindly explain.
So the Page Experience tab takes into account the Core Web Vitals plus all of the other factors. So that's why you might see a slight difference with regards to those two. And it might also be that the basis out of which the pages are counting are slightly different in those two reports. So that's something where usually what I recommend doing is with these aggregate reports is trying to recognize the issues, the problems, and focusing on those and not using the total count as a metric.
OK, thank you.
OK. Valbuff. Oh my gosh.
Hi, John. I have a blogging website, and it was ranking on number one or two position in many keywords. But after the Google product review update, my website ranking pushed down to 10 or 11 on the same keyword. So my question is, how can I improve my content according to the Google product review update to regain my position?
It's hard to say without knowing your website. So that's kind of first off. What I would recommend doing is double checking the blog post that we have with all of those tips on there, and also double checking some of the external blog posts that were made around the product review update, where people bring in some more information from things like the quality rater guidelines and some of the other kind of aspects that could also play a role with regards to review-based content or content that might be perceived as being focused on reviews.
If you can explain about the Google product review update, because there's a lot of confusion related to it.
I can't go through all of the details here. I would really recommend taking a look at the blog post, because it's pretty comprehensive and has a lot of information in there.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you.
Sure. Divakar.
Yeah, hi, John. I am from New Delhi, India.
Hi.
Hi. So my question is related to international targeting tool under Search Console. From last few years, I am seeing that this tool comes under legacy tools category in Search Console. And when we try to access this tool, then it will redirect us to the old version of Search Console. So just to know better about this tool, just to know the future about tool, I just wanted to know that is the importance of the tool is still the same as it was previously? Or Google wanted to retire this tool in future sometime?
I don't know. It's still in Search Console, so it's still supported. I would continue to use it. It's not something where we say we're going to remove it completely because we would have removed it already. I don't know what the near-term future is, if we will update it or if we will decide in the end that maybe we don't need it as much as we thought we would. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Okay. But its importance is currently same as it was previously.
Yes, exactly. It still works. Okay. It's still okay. Functional.
Okay, okay. Perfect, perfect. Thank you. Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks. Rushika.
So, hi, John. So this is Ruchika from Ahmedabad, India. So my question is, like, usually a site page or a site ranking do depend on the how stable the site is. Like, if you make frequent changes on the site, the ranking goes down, right?
Not necessarily. Just because you make changes doesn't necessarily mean it's worse. It shouldn't go down the ranking.
Actually, we recently made many changes, like content-wise and also like designing-wise. We have made some changes, and yeah, our ranking has gone down a lot, like from 11 to in 30s, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you make changes on your website, then in search we will try to reflect that, and if our systems, when they look at the new website, see that everything is better than before, we will try to rank it better. But if they see that things are maybe not as good as they were before, then it can happen that it goes down in ranking as well. So in particular, if you do things like changing the layout in a way that changes the internal linking within the website, then that's something where we would look at that and say, we can understand the structure better, or maybe we can't understand the structure as good as it was before. And that can have a pretty visible effect on the rankings.
So it doesn't make any sense, because like we have just made some recent changes, like content, like adding more keywords and yeah, making the pages more appealing, like the product page. So
yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to say what you made, what kind of changes you made, and how that worked out. I am kind of worried when you say we just added more keywords, because that sounds like keyword stuffing almost, and kind of going in that direction. But it's really hard. What I would recommend doing there is taking a sample of the pages from your website and maybe converting them back to how they were before, and then seeing if that change in content was really the issue that changed things for rankings. And then based on that, you can decide what you need to do.
OK. Thank you, John.
Sure. Let me run through some of the submitted questions for a bit, and then I'll get back to the live questions as well. Wow, so many people, so many questions. OK, let me see. What contact information is it better to indicate on the author's page, social network accounts, email addresses, or both? If we can choose only one option, what is more preferable? So I thought this was actually a pretty interesting question. I don't think we've had run across this before. So essentially, what I see on our side is when it comes to things like author pages or information about the author or information about entities in general behind a website, an article, or something, what happens there is our systems try to recognize who that is, what that entity is. And we do that based on a number of different factors. And that does include things like links to profile pages, for example, or visible information that we can find on these pages themselves. So my recommendation here would be to at least link to a common or kind of like a central place where you say like everything comes together for this author, which could be something like a social network profile page, for example, and use that across the different author pages that you have when you're writing, so that when our systems look at an article and they see an author page associated with that, they can recognize, oh, this is the same author as the person who wrote something else, and we can kind of group this by entity, and we do that based on maybe this common social networking profile that is there. Long ago, we used to have the rel author annotation, and all of the older SEOs will probably facepalm now, but it's something essentially where we try to use structured data to explicitly apply this, but it is something that like the rel author annotations are no longer used at Google for quite a while now. But we do try to understand who the entity is behind an author page. And for many authors, it's pretty clear. Like there's one name, and it's very obvious this one name is associated with this one person. For other people, it can be a little bit more complicated. Like me, for example, John Mueller, if you search for me, you'll find Wikipedia pages, barbecue restaurants, bands, all kinds of people who are called John Mueller. And if on my site I don't kind of specify who I actually am, then it could happen that our systems look at my pages and go, oh, this is that guy that runs that barbecue restaurant. And then suddenly I'm associated with a barbecue restaurant, which I don't know, might be a move up. I don't know. But kind of these subtle things, I think, make it a lot easier for us to recognize who is actually behind something. We call that reconciliation when it comes to structured data, kind of recognizing which of these entities belong together. Then a question about meta title and meta description. Google is showing the same title tag but the wrong description and automatically fetching data from my website. How can I correct that? So essentially, we try to use the information that you have on your pages when it comes to titles and descriptions. But when our systems recognize that maybe this information is not as useful to users as possible, then we will tweak that. And we can show different titles and descriptions based on the query, so that can vary from time to time. The best way to kind of work on making it so that Google does take into account your title and description is to make sure that you're following Google's guidelines with regards to titles and descriptions, and in particular, making sure to avoid keyword stuffing, making sure to avoid kind of making it overly, I don't know, clickbaity, the title and description, so that it's really something where our systems, when they look at it, say, oh, this is a good recommendation for this page. We will show that one. We still use the title in our search in ranking systems. Even if we've modified it in the search results, we don't use the description at all when it comes to ranking. It's really just what we would show in the search results. How can I deal with missed redirects for moving from HTTP to HTTPS? Does it make sense to catch up now? I'm new at the company, and back then they missed to do this. Is it now too late, or should we still do it? I would definitely still do that. So especially when it comes to HTTP, HTTPS, having that redirect in place, make sure that everyone is going to your HTTPS version. And then you can also set up HSTS, which is a way of automatically sending people to the HTTPS version of your site. So even if you didn't do it back then, I think just purely from a user best practice point of view, it makes sense to set up those redirects. I don't think you would see any visible effect when it comes to SEO, but really just from a user's point of view, it's still a big good practice, even if you didn't do it in the beginning. We've been working on improving our page speed scores. LCP lab data and field data are below 2.5 seconds, but Core Web Vitals still lists many pages as failing. Running revalidation doesn't help. Additionally, the number of failed pages changes erratically for no reason. It drops from 160 to 90 and then jumps up again a bit later. So the number of pages, as I mentioned in the beginning, that could be just based on the sample that we look at for your site. And that sample size can vary over time. So that might be something that's less relevant to worry about. I would focus more on the number of issues that are found, and in particular, the kind of sample URLs that are shown there, the patterns that are shown for the individual issues. With regards to page speed scores versus Core Web Vitals in, I assume this is in Search Console, because it's essentially using the same thing. In Search Console, we use the Chrome User Experience Report, the field data, the real user metrics. And they take, I think, 28 days about to be updated. So as soon as you make changes on your website, and if they're visible enough that users would see them, then it takes that 28 days before we even start to see kind of a slight change in those metrics. And even then, you would not see that change kind of jumping up immediately, but rather you would see more of a subtle climb over time as things settle down with the new score. So that might be something that you're seeing there. The other thing that commonly pops up is the difference between lab data and field data. Essentially, with lab data, you're doing an approximation of what users might see. And that approximation might be wrong, because we don't know where your users are, what they would actually see. Because of that, it can happen that the approximation looks good, but the user data looks bad. Or similarly, the approximation looks bad, but the actual user data is pretty good. That's why you do sometimes see those differences. In general, when it comes to optimizing things for speed, I recommend using the user data, the field data, as a way of recognizing broader areas of problems, and then using the lab data to incrementally improve your website in that regard. So if you're seeing, for example, that CLS is really bad in the field data, then I'd recommend looking at the lab data for CLS and trying to figure out how can you significantly improve that. Maybe the numbers don't match up completely, but you do see those differences in kind of the scores over time, where if you're improving your website with the lab data, then you would assume that at some point that improvement will also trickle down to the field data as well. And sometimes that just takes a while. It's kind of a matter of patience, but also a matter of trying to find the right things to work on. Let's see. Is it common to see URLs of images in crawled, currently not indexed report in Search Console? The URLs return the correct file header for JPEG, but they don't contain a JPEG extension. Yes, that can happen. So essentially, we have kind of some heuristics in place to recognize when you're linking to images. And when we can tell that a link goes to an image, then we will say, oh, this is probably an image. And we will process it in image search. And we won't even look at it for web search. However, if we can't recognize that it's an image, then we'll try to crawl that URL for web search. And then kind of the crawler will say, actually, there was no web page here. Within web search, we'll say, oh, we weren't able to index this page. And that's not necessarily a bad sign. It's just essentially us telling you we tried to crawl these URLs, and we just didn't get a web page out of it. And from that point of view, it's more of an informational thing for you to understand, well, Google tried to crawl, so you'll see it in your logs, but they weren't actually indexed as web pages. Probably they ended up being indexed as images, which is something you'd have to kind of try to figure out almost indirectly, because we don't have the same index coverage report for images as well. But you could see maybe in the performance report which landing pages are showing images, and then you can double check to see what is actually shown in Google Images for those pages. that's, I think one of the things that I would take out of this is, if you're seeing issues with regards to your images being indexed and you know they don't have image extensions, then it might be worthwhile to swap those around and make it at least look like they have image extensions so that we can process them immediately with Google Images rather than going through web search and then thinking, oh, they're not web pages, maybe they're images, and we'll try that there. For a particular page, I discovered in Search Console that it has poor LCP on mobile. Except the LCP, no other Core Web Vitals are reported as poor or bad for the same URL. But calling the PageSpeed Insights API, I saw that according to the field data, the page also has a bad CLS score. Why is that not shown in Search Console as well? I don't know. It's really hard to say on an individual URL basis. What I would recommend doing is not worrying too much about individual pages unless they are very critical and important pages for your site, and instead focusing on the broader pattern for your website. So for example, if you have a template for your blog and there are individual pages that are not OK, but overall most of them are OK, then I would see that as something like probably that's OK. On the other hand, if you have kind of for your main product, a very unique landing page, and that is not OK with regards to these Core Web Vitals, then that would be something that I would focus on. But especially when you're looking at individual pages across the different tools, you kind of need to keep in mind that the tools have a different databases in the sense that the report in Search Console is based on groups of URLs. The reports in PageSpeed Insights are also kind of based on the information we have for one URL, plus for the origin overall, plus the lab test as well. So all of these reports could have slightly different bases. In general, I think it can get very tricky when you're looking at individual pages like this. My recommendation is really to kind of try to take a step back and look at the overall patterns rather than focusing too much on individual pages, especially if those pages are part of a common theme that you have across your website. Let's see, and there's a question, another one about Core Web Vitals. Wow, everything. We've done everything we could to get the lab data below the required numbers. However, field data is still not changing. Again, there's the time difference that is there on the one hand, and on the other hand, the factor of the lab tests being an approximation. Essentially, they're guessing at what the field data might be for an individual score based on specific assumptions that they make, like with regards to how fast the connection is, what kind of a device it might be, all of these things. And all of that can vary from site to site, depending on where the users are, what kind of devices they have, what connections they have. So that's something where I would use the lab data to incrementally improve, but I would use the field data as kind of the basis of truth for the site. What you can also do, if you don't have time to wait those 28 days or so for the field data to start updating, is you can annotate your pages with a specific JavaScript snippet that you can use to make it so that you can track the Core Web Vitals of those individual pages in something like your analytics system. And there are various snippets that we have on web.dev, our developer site for Chrome, where you can add some JavaScript to your pages and then track the CLS, or you can track the largest contentful paint, all of those things. And you can track those then in analytics. And then fairly quickly, you start seeing, were these changes OK? Were the changes not OK? You can also compare different individual pages. If you have like ABC versions of a page where you're making individual changes and not sure which one is the best, then you can track that a little bit faster as well. Is it possible to rank a single page website? Yes, absolutely. So that's It doesn't need to have a lot of pages on a website. We can rank a website that consists of a single page. My general recommendation when you're working on a website is to try to build out one website and make it as strong as possible and to kind of grow that over time rather than to create a bunch of disconnected single page websites. Sometimes you just want something completely separate that maybe you use as an advertising landing page as well. And that can absolutely appear in the search results. It can absolutely rank fairly well as well. For a while, it was very, I don't know, fashionable to have single page websites, really long pages, kind of these longer experiences. But it's totally up to you. You can try it out. My mobile URLs have an LCP problem, but not in the AMP version. The mobile search results already have AMP URLs, so can I just ignore the LCP issue? Maybe you can ignore it. So like I mentioned in the beginning, we use the page that is actually shown to users as the basis for tracking these things. So if you have valid AMP pages, and we're always showing the valid AMP version to users when they search on mobile, then that's what we will take into account. Whereas if you have an AMP version, but it's not a valid AMP version, so sometimes we don't show it as an AMP version in the search results, then we would take whatever page that users see in the search results and use that as the basis. So that's kind of the different things there. With regards to connected AMP pages, one of the things to keep in mind is that we would fold those scores together. So on the one hand, if you have something like a slash AMP page and a slash web page, we would fold those scores together. And also the score that we would have from the AMP cache, if we're serving your AMP page from the AMP cache, we would also fold that together and kind of make one score for that page based on the canonical itself. So that kind of comes together there. And if we're always showing your AMP pages, always showing them from the AMP cache, then that's kind of what would be taken into account. The other thing to keep in mind is that we track this data not based on what is shown in search results and where people click from the search results, but essentially based on what people see when they are within your website. So if they go to your AMP page on the AMP cache and they click on a link and all of the links lead to your traditional mobile page, then suddenly they're on the mobile page and the experience that they're seeing is based on what they see on the mobile page. So that's kind of that mix of AMP cache, AMP, and mobile page. That's something that you can also kind of control a little bit with regards to how you set up your internal linking. If you link your AMP pages with your AMP page, then they'll probably stay within the AMP version. Whereas if you link your AMP pages to your traditional mobile version, then it's very likely that if someone stays on your site for a little bit longer, which is usually a good thing, that they end up on your traditional mobile version. So we're kind of running low on time. Maybe I'll switch to one or two more questions from you all. I also have a bit more time afterwards. So if any of you want to stick around more off the record, then welcome to join in as well. Let's see. From names, like with the hands, Xiao, I think you're next.
I think Ruchika first before me.
I think she already asked before.
Oh, I see. OK, thank you. So my question is about Google product review. So I just wondering if the domain that we posted that review matter, because previously you mentioned the product review content is optimized for professional product review. So for example, but what I mean is that if I am Apple.com and I write a review about a different computer, it will obviously be biased, right, compared to more like seemingly neutral site like consumerreported.com or something like that. So would Google rank something that seemingly less biased websites product review higher than say a brand write an article about their product or even compare their product to their competitors?
I don't know. My guess is there will be some kind of a mix where we take the different kinds of reviews into account and then rank them like that. I don't think we would have something explicitly saying that this review was written by the company that actually made the product, therefore we should ignore it. But I really don't know. Because it can also happen that the company that makes the product has a collection of fairly serious reviews by more neutral providers. But I don't know.
So if I am the brand, I can write both my own product and my computer's product and posting on my own domain, and they can potentially still rank high.
It's possible, yeah.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Sure. All right, Sanjay.
Hi. I have another question about Core Web Vitals. We receive traffic from three devices, tablet, mobile, and desktop. So my question is, will Google consider tablet data in the rankings or not?
I think at the moment we don't. Especially for the Core Web Vitals, we only differentiate between mobile and desktop. And we plan on only using mobile, at least for the moment. So it's possible that can change over time. But at least the current plan is only on mobile.
OK. And I have another question about the e-commerce. If we create a master page for agent pages, like a mobile phone with 128 GB, 256 GB, and we create a master page for all of those variant pages and canonicalize variant pages to the master page, right? And if a user searches for the variant page, will Google show our canonicalized page?
Probably, yes. If we follow that rel canonical and we focus on the canonical page, we will only show the canonical page. And we'll only be able to rank and index that based on the information on the canonical page. So for example, if on the canonical page you say, we have three variants, 1, 2, 3, and you just link out to the different variants, and then on the variant page you say, well, this is the blue iPhone and this is the green iPhone. If someone searches for blue iPhone and those words are not on your kind of combined page, then we will probably not be able to rank that page. So the things that you want to your users to be able to find, you should make sure that it's also on the canonical page.
OK. Can I ask another question?
Sure.
So when I use the Lighthouse tool, it suggests us to use no referral, no opener for outlinks, for external links that we are providing outbound links. So and it says that it can affect security and performance. And using no referral and no opener can help us in this. Can you help me to understand what is the use of no referral and no opener in case of for performance or SEO?
I don't think it changes anything for SEO. So it's purely a usability and security best practice. So for ranking, I don't think it changes anything. I kind of have a vague recollection of what those two attributes do, but I would really recommend checking out the documentation for them, and then based on that, deciding on what you do. I think no refer essentially just doesn't pass a refer along, so that's usually less a matter. And the no opener is something that is more used for security reasons.
So it will not affect our performance, like speed matrices.
That's correct. It doesn't affect. Doesn't affect speed, definitely, because it's just a different type of link on your page. It doesn't affect SEO either, because we can still see the rest of your content on those pages.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Jan?
Hello, John.
Hi.
I have a question about responsive images and which one Google tries to rank. I've put a little piece of code in the chats just to have some kind of sense what I'm trying to say. I was wondering which images Google eventually indexes or crawls. I'm guessing you crawl all URLs or all sources, but maybe you just index one. Is it the biggest one, or is it the one in the source attributes?
For a while, it used to be just the one in the source attribute. I don't know if that has changed, but in general, it's very common for us to recognize multiple sizes of images and to index all of them, and to recognize that they're the same image. And then what will happen in the search results, in the image search results, if you click on the image, sometimes it shows the different versions as well for that image in that kind of that preview pane on the side. So that's something where it's usually less a matter of which one we pick. It's more that we can at least definitely index the one with the source tag, because that's kind of the standard setup. And if we can recognize the other sizes, then we could match those when people are explicitly searching for something like a larger image or a smaller image. But it's, I think for the most part, it's also something where sites tend not to care so much about the different image variations. They just want to be findable with any of the image variations.
Yeah. And would you say, if I understood correctly, that it's very important to have the source attribute? Because I think for the browser, if you just use the source set attribute, it would work just fine, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that changed in our systems at some point, that we also use the source set to pick up the different variations. But at least in the beginning, it was such that we only use the source. And I could imagine that other search engines also focus on only the source attribute.
OK, thank you. I don't know if I have time for one more question. I might.
Sure, sure. Go for it.
Regarding the Core Web Vitals, you mentioned the field data as being the one, and it's also in regards to ranking only focused on mobile. In the FAQs, you also, or somebody from Google also said that it's kind of in the cutting edge, or how do you say it, when it's two equally relevant pages striving for the top, then it might matter more in those situations. But what happens if you have like two pages, two websites with an equally relevant content, and then it's the question of one page with mediocre Core Web Vitals score and one page where you have insufficient data? Which one would outrank the other one?
I don't think we would have that defined. So that could vary. It's something that in practice is less likely to happen, because usually you would be comparing different sites in the same niche. And if they've been relevant kind of fairly similar in the past, then they have kind of similar traffic from search already. So they would be pretty much in a similar grouping already. So that's something where my guess is we will leave that undefined for the moment, and we'll try to figure out how to best deal with that. It's similar with other factors in search, where sometimes we just don't have a lot of information about a site, especially if a site is completely new and suddenly there's new content there, then our systems have to make assumptions. And sometimes those assumptions are more positive than the end result ends up being. Sometimes the assumptions are more negative than the end result ends up being. And this is something that we kind of have to fine tune over time. So I don't think we would have a kind of a clear definition where we'd say, like, if a page is in the 50% and the other page has no data, then we would always pick it this way or that way. I don't think we'd be able to define that.
OK, thanks.
Sure. OK, let me pause the recording here. You're welcome to stick around a little bit longer, but it's always good to have a reasonable length for the recording. Thank you all for joining. If you're watching this on YouTube, I hope you found this useful. And maybe you'll join one of the future Hangouts as well. All right. Let's pause here.